This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
I don't want to make boring clothes for a serious matter. I just want women to still feel great. When I see a woman down the street wearing my clothes, it makes me really happy because I know she's feeling good in it because she's wearing it. And I think it's great that she also gets a thing, nothing sort of untoward has gone on the way, so she can feel good about her purchase as well.
This is a series of podcasts about people at the top of the creative industries, their life and work and their relationship to luxury. Sustainability has become a buzzword in the fashion world recently, but my guest today is one of the few designers that puts that concept at the heart of everything they do. Amy Pani is the creative director of Mother of Pearl, a women's wear brand that she's transformed into one that combines luxury with affordability and without compromising on ethics. So Amy, welcome. You say that you make fashion with wit, heart and conscience.
Oh, I try.
What does it mean?
I mean, as a designer, you obviously like put the design and the integrity at the sort of forefront in a way, but I think ethics is just so important and I feel like it should be sort of woven into the entire processes. And I guess all those three words just bring together the idea of, you know, really conscious and careful and clever design, but also sort of interweaving all those really important things of ethics along the way.
As soon as you say it's ethics and sustainability, yeah. I can see people thinking like, oh yeah, sensible sandals and shades of mud brown.
Yeah.
Would you like to describe the sort of elements of a Mother of Pearl design? We're looking at a couple of them, yep, at the moment that are hanging here on the wall. These beautiful, that I really wanted, white cotton, yep, dress with pearl buttons.
Yeah.
And the other, a sort of golden russet peony covered piece of magnificence with a ruffle around the waist to hide the little rosé tummy that you might have at the end of summer.
Absolutely, yes. So sustainable fashion, I sort of say that inverted commas, had such a sort of bad rep with, you know, sort of cotton smock dresses, hemp, linen and, you know, all those dowdy things. And actually I sort of studied 14 years ago, I graduated now, and actually studied sort of ethical design on my own at uni. And back then it literally was just hemp and all those things you talked about. And I really wanted to make it my mission to, you know, let's make still beautiful product, design it at its forefront that women really want to wear, and let's do it well too, you know, sort of from an ethics point of view. So to make sure that we didn't just follow those connotations and really shifted the model and got the likes of Vogue and things to sort of say, actually, we're interested now rather than, oh God, I need to put that in that whole sort of hippie pile.
You talk about 14 years ago and,
yep,
and you were
depressing.
The only one. 14 years ago, it's only like a flicker of my eyelash in my lifespan, I can tell you. So it's not that long. But you talked about how, you know, you were pretty much out on your own then as a student, yeah, studying, yeah, kind of sustainable fashion. Yeah. I mean, were you really, I mean, was it even a subject then?
No, actually? I mean, they all thought I was totally bonkers on my course. I think fair trade at that point had emerged on the scene. And I remember sort of Chris Martin of Coldplay wearing his bands and that being a sort of thing. But sustainability, for sure, you know, the difference between an organic cotton, let's say, and what that meant, or kind of, you know, anything to do with environmental impact, just wasn't even a discussion. It's only just come out sort of the last couple of years. I think social welfare and that sort of whole fair trade was there, but everything else was just sort of brand new to people. People didn't connect the two things together, you know.
So what made you so interested in it? What made you so pioneering? I think you had a slightly off-the-grid, yeah, childhood.
Yeah, so for part of my childhood, my parents sort of following the idea of the good life and buying a piece of land and deciding to set up a caravan there. And bit by bit, my sort of father built the house. But there's no water, no electricity. We were completely off-grid. So it was, you know, basically like camping in the north of England in the rain most of the time.
And did this start when you were a teenager?
I was about 10 or 11, I think, when we first moved down there, yeah. And my father sunk a well, which is basically like sort of dropping a giant drain pipe into the ground to hit the water table. And it had a hand pump, sort of like you'd see in medieval times. And we used to sort of have to get the water out of the pump, into a bucket, and then go and sort of heat it up on a camping stove. And then sort of over time, as my dad started building the house, the electricity started coming from one of the first domestic wind turbines that was ever put up. And the water was from a bigger well at the back of the field that was actually pumped through the house, so it came out your tap, which was a real revelation for us. You could only have electricity when it was windy or not. Yeah, and sometimes in the winter when it was completely spinning, you could just have it on all night, which was like the best evenings. And of course, up north, it rains all the time. So in the caravan, TV on all night was just, yeah, the dream. Yeah.
And how do you think that that impacted on you, apart from probably a lot of resentment in your early teens?
I mean, it definitely wanted me to move to London, where all the lights and electricity were. people always think, oh, it must just be you sort of grew up in nature. You know, you didn't have sort of electricity. That must be why you're sort of passionate about sustainability. And actually, I think it was just the not readily available having things. You know, I couldn't just switch on a light switch, or I couldn't just put my favourite TV programme without begging my dad to sort of go and turn the generator on or something.
And what about, like, at school and stuff? Did other kids... I mean, kids can be quite cruel.
They were cruel.
You must have been a bit of an oddity in your caravan with no electricity.
Yeah, I was also really chubby. So really chubby living in a caravan, not such a good look, no. You know, it's character building, isn't it, at the end of the day. But
was it hard?
There was parts of it hard. Kids are just bloody cruel, aren't they? You know, they're just... I don't know, if you're different, let's say, that's it, you're done for. But I had real ups and downs and I had great friends and I had sort of good times. But there was a few moments of Gypsy Girl came in quite a lot, yeah.
Nice. And at what point, though, in that sort of existence and, you know, this chubby child at school, Gypsy Girl, at what point did you think, but it's fashion for me?
Do you know, it's funny, people ask me this a lot because so many people that get into fashion, I think their mothers gave them Vogue, or like they sort of watched their mother going out, you know, to events and things, and she was glamorous and it just made them sort of want to sort of, you know, uncover that. For me, it was actually the not fitting in that interested me in fashion, and the sort of desperation to have like an Adidas tracksuit like the cool kids at school had, and what sort of tribes meant and how you fit in, and that real idea of sort of identity coming from how you put yourself together. So creativity was like always my number one thing. Art was everything I wanted to do. That was always art, it was always creative.
And so did you at college, because you went to Kingston, didn't you? Were you thinking about very individual looks, or were you thinking about creating tribes? You know, it's like thinking about your one look as a punk, or, you know, how am I going to fit into this fraternity?
I think I tried a lot of things, actually, because sort of growing up in the north of England, you know, even the music we listened to was just top of the pops, you know, the charts and whatnot. And I got to art school and I was like, oh my God, this is like my dream come true. Sort of people that were like me and all this new stuff to uncover, and lots of people that have been brought up in quite creative backgrounds, so just knew lots about like music and subcultures and things. So I think for me, it was like a brand new sort of introduction into all these possibilities. So I think I tried a few different things along the way. I think there's some pretty dodgy photographs of some, some outfits that we tried, but...
Hoping you'll be getting them out later. Pretty soon after you left college, you started working at Mother of Pearl as a sort of general dog's buddy.
Yeah, I sort of graduated and needed a job. I needed money, and Mother of Pearl was like a tiny brand back then. It was a sort of a bit of a hobby brand at the time, and they were hiring and they were paying. So I used to do 3 days a week there, and it was a very different brand and a very different product that it is today.
You said it was a hobby label. It was started by Maya Norman.
Exactly, yeah.
Who was Damien Hirst's partner for a very long time and mother of his boys.
Yes, yeah.
And I, the other person was?
There was another one at the time called Sue, and she was really running it. So I didn't sort of spend much time with Maya maybe in the first couple of years because there was another woman at the helm. But a few years in, Maya really wanted to shake things up and have more of an input. So 2 years sort of on, she came in, and yeah, I guess that's when Maya and I sort of formed our relationship. And back then I sort of like stepped up a little bit more. So from sort of just cutting out fabric, I ran the office for her and sort of just evolved. And then, well, about 4 years ago, so 10 years after me starting, Maya just handed over the reins to me because we'd got such an amazing relationship by that point, and she knew how passionate I was about it, and she just said, I'm going to make you creative director and over to you.
What did you feel?
Yeah, I mean, it's
so young.
Yeah, I think everything I do it with so much conviction. So Mother of Pearl was always my baby in a way, you know, like I don't ever treat anything with anything other than 100%. That's just who I am, probably my downfall. So I just think, yeah, it was kind of like adopting something that you already felt was yours.
But you are like this tiny little island bobbing off a ginormous continent, you know, that is the fashion industry.
Yeah.
And although nowadays people are talking about sustainability and there is at least lip service being paid to it, and people like Olivia Firth are doing the Green Carpet Challenge, and you know, people are gradually becoming incrementally more interested, it still makes you very much out of the main current, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So How much do you think you can achieve? How difficult has it been
to
get to the point that you are now where your label No Frills, which is the...
It's like our core sort of diffusion line. We call it our Mother of Pearls, like everyday wardrobe. So the price points are lower. It's kind of more casual product. And then Mother of Pearl remains a sort of slightly quirky brand that it always has been. Yeah.
But you say the price points are low, but price points for Mother of Pearl are relatively low as well.
Yeah.
Considering what it looks like is an incredible expenditure of painstaking research and time in terms of sourcing your fabrics, sourcing your suppliers, you know, the manufacturers, everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of whole different way to develop your product. So once I sort of went to my development team and said, well, really, it was me and one other girl, Chloe. And I was like,
sounds good.
Yeah. I was like, Chloe, we're doing this. And she was like, okay. Neither of us had any sort of background really getting to the roots of where our stuff was made from. You know, how do you even get to your cotton farms? Like, is that even an option? And we just researched, we Googled, we got on planes, we went to different places, but we had to flip the development process right on its head. So everything you'd learn and everything you'd worked on before in how you actually design and create a garment, you had to completely flip it around. So instead of just drawing something and you're thinking, great, I want to make this dress, like, can we find this fabric and whatnot? It was, what raw materials do I have available that are sustainable, and how am I going to produce that in the most ethical way? What can I make from it? So it's really like the sort of opposite to how you normally work. And we still work in exactly the same way, yeah.
So I've mentioned the two pieces hanging on our window frame.
Yeah.
And I wonder, maybe you could just give an example of the places you've gone and the people you work with. Just give me an example of where these two would come from.
So the piece on the right, which is the cotton dress with the pearls placket down
which
the front.
Which I really want, by the way.
That's a very goodie. I have that in stripe. So basically, the cotton is all organic cotton. And for us, we wanted to work out where our cotton farms are, because there's a lot of horrendous stories. I think in India, 270,000 cotton pickers have committed suicide in the last 20 years for this industry. So we wanted to make sure we were sourcing our cotton correctly, that it was done organically, we were using minimal pesticides and chemicals. And Turkey is the second biggest producer of organic cotton on the planet. So we ended up there, we found some suppliers that we were happy with. And then it's about, can we also produce that garment in close proximity? So can we create vertically integrated manufacture systems? That sounds a bit complicated, but what it means is, in a garment, you have to grow the raw material, pending it's a natural fibre. You have to spin the fibre into a yarn. You have to weave it into a cloth, and then you have to turn it into your garment. So that's a lot of processes. So many of your garments might have travelled to 5 to 10 countries before you receive them. We thought, can we stop that cycle and just create one country of origin from start to finish to eliminate packaging and shipping, packaging and shipping, packaging and shipping? So then we ended up in Turkey, we got the cotton that we wanted, we were happy with the suppliers, and then we found a manufacturer who we were pleased with too. So that dress on the right is all produced with a really minimal carbon footprint because it's from, you know, all the same country. But then, of course, we don't just want boring cotton dowdy shirts that are sort of hemp-like, or,
you know, if they're all a bit like that, then nothing hemp-like about that.
Exactly. And then we add our pearls, which unfortunately aren't sustainable right now because that's a bit complicated. But yeah, just how can we then turn it into a product that women just really want to wear, make them feel good? And we found out it was cheaper too. The way we redeveloped meant our whole line came down in price because we thought about development in a completely different way. So vertically integrating something, instead of having lots of different middlemen and packaging and shipping and packaging and shipping, we actually reduced all the costs. So we gave you a sustainable product, cheaper than we'd ever made it before, but still without it looking like sort of sustainable dowdy clothes.
Well, it's incredible. Now, talk me through the russet one, because that's really beautiful. It looks like kind of old Florentine print or something.
Peonies was the right. You said that before. That is the print. So this isn't as traced back to the same extent that the shirt is, because this is part of our Mother of Pearl line. So basically, this is a viscose fibre. Now, viscose is not the best fibre on the planet. It's still better than polyester, but it's not the best because a lot of chemicals are used in the process. But also, viscose comes from trees, which means trees are cut down constantly to make our viscose fibres. So we make sure for every single tree that is cut down for these pieces, it doesn't come from ancient forests, so nothing is destroyed along the way, no habitats and things. And for every tree that's cut down, there's another one planted. And it's all digitally printed, which is much better for the environment, and it's produced in our Portugal factory, who we work with all the time and are very happy, and we know them very well. But it is still a viscose fibre, which is not the best one, but it's much better than a lot of things you see on the market.
And obviously you have to exist within the fashion world, you know.
Yeah.
Do people think you're completely mad?
Probably. No, do you know what? I've actually, what's been incredible about this journey is I got to a point where I thought, I just can't do this anymore unless I do it properly. We were making tiny quantities. I tend, you know, to creative director, we started selling a lot of product. And I just thought, I can't do it anymore unless I do it right. When you learn the facts of the 270,000 cotton pickers killing themselves, you just think, OK, I can't do this anymore. I have to change. So I did it for myself, really, and my team. But the brilliant thing off the back of it was cheaper. We still got to make this brilliant product. But also, the amount of love we've received since we've done it is phenomenal. I think there's a lot of people in the industry that are tired and exhausted. And, you know, imagine editors that have to constantly write columns in magazines about how to get this look for like 10p. And, you know, I think everyone was just feeling a bit exhausted. And I think this line meant that they could still celebrate fashion and feel better about it. So we've received like a massive amount of love off the back of it, which, again, wasn't why I did it. I didn't do it for the glory, but the fact that the brand has grown and people love it even more, it's just been a win-win-win, you know, scenario. It makes it much easier to get up and love your job even more every day, you know?
I mean, you talk about it in such a positive way, but there must be challenges to your approach. What's been the most difficult thing?
I think it's at design stage when, you know, you're sort of a creative and you really want to make something that, you know, and you just can't do it because if you do it, it's not sustainable. And I might want to make a beautiful leather jacket, but then you just think, God, does the world need it? No, it doesn't. We can wear jackets that aren't made out of leather. So every now and again, you sort of really want to make something and you just have to really rein yourself back in and sort of put a few barriers in there, which is sometimes a little bit frustrating. And of course, our development team and myself, you know, designing isn't just this fun, fab, creative process in a way anymore. It's quite a methodical, mathematical, you know, we have to think about everything in the supply chain when we're thinking about a product. So it adds a lot more layers, but I don't know, you're doing it for the right reasons. So it sort of doesn't feel that horrendous, you know.
Is there a sense, though, as well, I mean, you know, if you visited the places where these things are made, I mean, obviously the 270,000 suicides in India is, you know, just a horrendous statistic. But you know, you worked in places like Paraguay and in Peru.
Yeah. I mean,
you must have seen close up just the daily sort of difficulties and injustices of those systems, even when you're doing it the right way or trying to.
Yeah. I mean, I think, to be honest, a lot of the stuff that's sort of really dodgy is really undercover. Like, people don't really let you get there. So I haven't actually seen anything sort of, you know, harrowing or anything. And we've never worked with factories that aren't top-notch anyway. So, like, I've never really experienced, like, horrendous social situations. But, you know, you sort of see the farmers and they're tired and they're exhausted and they don't get very much money. And when we're in Peru, we're sort of on the alpaca farms and we've sort of shown this fabulous alpaca farm by this company who took us around. And then when you really dug into it, you realise there was lots of very sort of poor farmers living in the mountains that couldn't even shear the alpacas without, like, with the proper equipment. They were using sort of a bit of old glass and things and they were probably selling it for a few pennies and whatnot. So, you know, I do think there's a real struggle for a lot of people at the bottom of the supply chain. And people always talk about manufacture and sort of the Rana Plaza issues in India, and, you know, and that is a massive problem. But we all forget about the spinners and the weavers and the farmers. The farmers right at the beginning have the worst time. They have a bad time here. It's like, imagine how it is, you know, at the bottom of a cotton picking line when you're buying cotton fabric for like £2 a metre. I mean, once you've spun it and woven it and picked it in the very first place and finished it, how much money are these people getting? I mean, pennies, you know?
And do you think that customers are, I mean, I can understand, you know, it's fantastic to have a mission when you're making something and you're making, doing it as a living.
Yeah.
But then there's the opposite side of the coin, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, when I was a teenager, you know, clothes cost money. So you had a couple of pairs of jeans and you were thrilled, you know, if you had a couple of pairs of jeans. You know, now you can, if you're young or even if you're not, buy a ton of things and you can have all this choice. And and it's quite hard to talk people out of that.
I know.
You know, even young people who are full of zest and a desire to rebel.
I know. It's too easy. When I was a kid, you know, if I wanted, I couldn't have the clothes that the other kids had at school, you know, that I desperately wanted. I had to go and get a job and save up for them. And they were like pride of place in my wardrobe, you know. And I feel like it's that we need to get back. But it's so accessible and it's so easy. And I was actually in Parliament on Monday trying to talk about putting legislation in place and things, because, you know, I think there needs to be some real shift and real change. And just doing it from education and grassroots up is really hard to get people out of that habit. And in a way, you know, coming from that background, I like the fact that we can celebrate fashion, whatever your salary or whatever sort of position you're in, but it's just gone to the next extreme. And I heard a statistic recently, which is by 2050, the fashion industry is set to make up 25% of the carbon footprint on the planet, which is harrowing, really, for clothing, you know? So I don't really know the best way to educate. I'm just trying to make a solution for people and talk about it and educate people. But to stop them pressing that button, I think maybe legislation is the only way forward, really.
And I suppose turning clothes back into a luxury item.
Yeah, it's the emotional relationship you need with it, you know? Like, we all know if you purchase something that you've saved up for, or you love, or it's a piece of, especially from a store like Harrods, you know, you really buy something of quality, you don't throw that stuff away, you know? So I think it's really important that we have this emotional relationship with the things that we love again, and we're not just in the habit of treating clothing like...
How does that principle infect your designing? Because, I mean, one of the things I'd say about Mother of Pearl is there is a sort of sense of exuberance and fun about them,
yeah,
that are sort of almost at odds in a way with the seriousness of your intent.
I think it's really important to celebrate and inspire. And I actually think for my history of time on the planet so far, people react better to inspiration rather than negative information. So I just wanted to make sure that all our communication, our messaging and our products still just made you feel great and had a sense of humour about it, and that's why the wit comes into it as well. I don't want to make boring clothes for a serious matter. I just want women to still feel great. Like, that's the best part of my job. When I see a woman down the street wearing my clothes, it makes me really happy because I know she's feeling good in it because she's wearing it. And I think it's great that she also gets to think nothing sort of untoward has gone on the way, so she can feel good about her purchase as well.
And do you have an idea of who the Mother of Pearl customer is?
It's funny, actually. We're such a global brand, so it's so hard to sort of work her out. But, you know, I hope she's definitely sort of doesn't take herself too seriously. And I think she's probably still creative in some form because we're still a bit quirky. I think she's just quite a sort of fun-loving person, you know?
But if she logs onto your website, she's going to get quite serious, because actually, unlike the website for, I think, any other fashion company that I've ever looked at, not that I've looked at that many, you know, yours is, I mean, it must be at least 50% about the messaging, about, you know, describing the journey, where the clothes are from, how they're made, you know, getting your message across.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have investors or what your business model is, but it must be quite scary to money people.
Well, we have no investors. I do it all on my own, which is really stressful. But, you know, really, if you click onto shop, you don't see anything other than the product. So you have to want to click onto the other sort of tabs, I guess, in a way to read about it. Because really my aim was also to educate too, because it's so complex. You know, how do you even know about the fact viscose comes from a wood pulp, you know, that comes from trees? Like, it's too complicated. So it's there for people to learn if they want to learn it.
Is it taught more at college now? I mean, you were obviously, you know, kind of a little pioneer 14 years ago.
Yeah.
But what about now?
Do you know, it's slightly depressing, actually, because I went to Graduate Fashion Week this time. They asked me to do a talk there, and I had a sort of army of students all queued up to talk to me after, which was quite overwhelming. And actually, really depressingly, they were all just sort of like, oh, I've dyed this with an avocado in my bath, or, oh, I've got this sort of beetroot and I've dyed this. And I thought, bloody hell, what? They haven't moved on, and the universities aren't teaching them what you can make. And I point at our clothes up on the window there, because you can make still luxury, fabulous, great fashion done better. And it sort of was pigeonholing them. And I just felt like that was really hard for an employer to sort of pick them up, because they'd focus so much on beetroot dyeing rather than kind of anything that would really help them get a job. So I feel like they've done a disservice, actually. So I really want to work with the education system, actually, to see if there's any way we can kind of instill or put a project out there to the BA courses and, you know, sort of help them learn that you can still create great product. You just need to rethink your, you know, supply chain.
Yeah, because in a way it sort of answers my next question, which is whether, you know, this is a phase, you know, it's like a fashion thing, like feminism's been very fashionable for a couple of years. Yeah. And you think, no, it's not about fashion, it's about equality.
Yeah,
You know, is there a sense that this is a phase and everyone's listening right now, but, you know, it could be unfashionable in a year's time? I mean, we don't really have that luxury, do we? But
well, I think the difference today that, because it has sort of come up and down in the media before, but I think climate change is on our doorstep. I think the can of worms is open. So I don't think it can be a phase. Whether the subject of fashion becomes a bit of a phase is to be seen. But if we're talking about 25% of the carbon footprint by 2050 in fashion alone, you know, imagine the rest of it's probably oil and gas and food industry. I don't think that can go anywhere, really. I think the can of worms is fully open and climate change is on our doorstep. I think some of the big groups, the Caring Group and things like that, I do think they're sort of putting more and more work into it. I guess in the luxury industry, it's easier because you've got bigger margins on things. So I think it's maybe easier to develop. And I think in a lot of cases with luxury too, you don't really have an issue with the sort of factories they're producing in because they're high quality. They might be Italian or Portugal. Portuguese or, you know, European at least. That's not to be said, though, sometimes that just because it's expensive doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it is better. But I do think there's a lot more movement in that sector.
And what did your good life, you know, grid-eschewing parents think about you turning to the fashion industry? Do you think they knew that you were going to do something different and special, or did you think they thought, what's happened to our daughter? She should be growing our own vegetables, not making clothes.
I mean, it is such a sort of different world to the way my parents live. I mean, we didn't even have a mirror in our house growing up. And, you know, my mom was just not the Vogue reading woman that sort of was going out all the time. She was a really hardworking woman, actually. And they worked on the farms. That was my childhood. So for them, it's like a completely different world. And the first time they came to one of my shows, I think they were just sort of sat there like looking at it thinking, God, this is a completely different environment to anything we've seen before. So it's completely different, but I think we have a lot of, I guess, same ground on our kind of views on. My sister has a forest school on the piece of land we grew up, so she's trying to educate the new ones. And, you know, I think it sort of runs in our family. It's just I took it in a way that is pretty abstract from the way they think, yeah.
But you are like a walking advert for deprivation, really, in childhood.
Yeah.
I'm starting to think I'm Wolfram. Oh, life's going to change for my two when I get home, I can tell you that. I'm dying to see what your luxury is.
So it sounds slightly cheesy, actually, but I brought a picture of the planet because I don't know if you've been watching the Netflix series One Strange Rock. Do you know what? It's the best documentary I've ever seen in that sort of sector. And it sort of brings the whole thing together. You understand how important everything and how unlikely life was in the first place. And for me, that made me think, what could be more luxury than all those very impossible things coming together to give us life? And sort of everything you're seeing at the moment with, you know, extinction and things of a lot of species, which is so sad. I just think, is luxury not this brilliant thing that we have now? And maybe we won't have it in 20 years' time. So maybe it's a little bit cheesy, but that's my luxury.
And I'm thinking you're probably not a big consumer, but if I did let you run rampant in Harrods.
Yeah. To be honest, I'm so time poor that for me, luxury is time, actually. So I'd be in the Moroccan spa, I think, and then in the food hall. Yeah. Also, I love food, being the chubby child and all that.
I'll see you there, Amy. Thank you very much
indeed.
Thanks
for having me.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Amy Powney. Next week, I'll be joined by the designer Jenny Packham, who's made more red carpet dresses than she's had hot dinners for the likes of the Duchess of Cambridge and Dieter von Teese. This series is recorded in Harrods in London. Thank you to our sponsor, Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.